Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Before we begin, a few preliminary things. First of all, with regards to attendance, instead of taking roll, we're going to be putting a bunch of sheets in the back where you can sign your name. So that's going to be coming by the break time, inshallah ta'ala. So sign your name and put your time that you actually came in. And please just be honest about that, okay? Second thing is, before we begin, is there any feedback that people would like to give just for a few minutes? How was the class last week? The new file that was sent? Yeah, so the syllabus, needs to be updated. So basically, the thing is for the syllabus, there was the sections that were mentioned, right, in the syllabus. So don't follow the page numbers. If there's a conflict, always follow the sections. That's going to be guaranteed way. Because there's actually two versions of the Islamic, in another class, there's two sections of the book as well. So just always follow the sections. You won't go wrong, inshallah. Okay, then remember, before we begin again, my advice to everyone is don't get intimidated. Don't think of quitting. Don't think of any of these things. Just keep attending. If anyone wants to attend the classes and they just don't want to take the test, or it's just too much for them, or they can't handle it or whatever, just go ahead and attend the class anyways and stick in the class. If you don't want to take the quizzes at all or the tests, you don't even want to try it because it intimidates you or whatever, please send an email to the TA letting him know that, you know, you're in that status, you're going to attend, but you don't want to go through all of that. So it'll just make it easier for him, so he doesn't have to grade it, he can keep a separate tally of people. Okay, so if you have that, please send an email, and that's fine. You'll learn something. The letters that were there on the grades have been removed. Because I think probably some people got intimidated by a letter grade they got. If they got 70%, like C-, you know, that's bad. Don't worry too much about it. It's going to get better in time and all of that. I know some of the questions may have been a little bit difficult or tricky or whatever, strange. So give us the feedback if you feel that any question is, this should not have been worded this way. One of them we've already modified in one of the questions. The next thing is study schedule, okay? How many of you actually made a study schedule? Raise your hand. You made like a time where I'm going to study in the week, these are my times, and I'm going to stick to it. Raise your hand again. How many of you actually made it? Okay? I'm telling you, if you start falling behind and you didn't make a study schedule, then you can only blame yourself. I'm very seriously saying that. If you made the study schedule and then you're falling behind, even though you're trying with the study schedule, we made a mistake then. So please, please make a study schedule for yourself. Otherwise, it's going to be difficult to balance things. Yes? To take the test and get certified? I mean, without attending the classes or reading or anything? I mean, if you can pass the entire test, I can give you the final exam right now, inshallah, and alhamdulillah, I won't mind. Just talk to me afterwards, yeah. Talk to me after. If you're ready for the final exam, we can give it to you, inshallah. It's not a problem. Remember, it's over 3 hours, though. So just be ready for that, inshallah. Yeah.
If you fail it, can you just keep taking class?
No, you can't just keep taking the class. Perhaps if IOC needs more donation, then we can just keep charging you every time you take the final. Alhamdulillah. Fi sabilillah, right? All right, so please make a study schedule for yourself. Test tips. So some people ask me, how can I do better on the test? How can I, get better scores on the free response? First of all, remember, the free response is open book. Okay, the free response is open book, so you can actually go through the text that you have, or the book, the reading that you have. You can go through it, and you have, you'll have, let's say, 60 minutes, whatever. If we decide to change it to 60, you'll have 60 minutes. You can go through it. Whatever you do, though, do not plagiarize. If you try and copy and paste from a text, or you try and type the same words or something, we'll see it and we'll know it. And you're going to lose all your points for that. So don't plagiarize, number one, from the book. Don't plagiarize from your friend, because we will be able to catch that most probably as well. And there's a grading syllabus. Is the syllabus public for all the people to see? Yeah, so there's a rubric. There's a grading rubric that is public, and you can see it on Canvas. So you can see exactly what you need to get a 3, exactly what you need to get a 2, what you would get for, we would get a 1. All of the things are mentioned in there. So please, take a look at the rubric and you'll understand exactly how we're grading. And if you have any more questions on details, like why did this happen or whatever, you can always email the TA and he'll explain to you where, some of your points were going off, okay? Yeah. No, free response is open to everything. You can use your books, you can use you know, Sheikh Google, you can use your friend, whatever. But for asking questions, don't go and ask someone else to help write it for you. That's the only thing. Just be honest about it, okay? And lastly, I don't mind at all that people are sending me messages. It's perfectly fine. But please, whenever you send a question in Canvas, make sure it's relevant to the course. So if you want to ask me any other question that's outside of the course, use my email address. But if you want to ask me something with regards to the course, then you can use the Canvas messaging system. I'm getting a lot of questions that, like, about like all that stuff, you know, halal meat and like all these things, right? So please email me that and don't use Canvas. I don't mind, I'll answer it, but don't use Canvas for that, inshallah, okay? All right, let's begin. Bismillah, alhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salamu ala rasulillah, wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in, amma ba'd. Allahumma allimna ma yanfa'una wa anfa'na bima allamtana, innaka antal alimul hakeem. Today we're going to be covering the house of Allah, the Kaaba, how it was built, how it came about. We're going to be talking about the age of ignorance, the time before the life of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and you know, how society was at that time. And we're going to talk a little bit about Arabia, its geography, and its political situation. Okay, so how many of you read, by the way, before coming here? MashaAllah, very good. So pretty good. So this is going to be more in-depth then. So the house of Allah. When we talk about the life of the Prophet, peace be upon him, we actually want to look at the background circumstances about his life, about where he lived, about all of these things. And that's why the story of the Prophet actually starts earlier than the 7th century, earlier than the 4th century, thousands of years earlier than that, and it goes all the way back to the time of Prophet Ibrahim, or Prophet Abraham. Now, Prophet Ibrahim, you find that there are three people who trace their narrative back to him. And that is the Muslims, the Christians, and the Jews. All three people primarily trace their origins back, and they make a claim about Prophet Ibrahim, and they say, well, we believe in him, and he's the person that we're following. And as Muslims, we make the same claim, and we say, no, there are some things that other people believe about him that may not be exactly correct. He was a Muslim in the full sense of the word, meaning he submitted himself to Allah. Now, when we go back to Prophet Ibrahim, the text that we have to go off of is the Quran and the reports of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, like hadith, all of these things. But the other people who talk about Ibrahim, there are some books written about his life, but almost all of them trace their sources back to one thing, and that is to the Old Testament, or to what's known as the Torah, supposedly the Torah that's there, the book of Genesis. Now, what does the book of Genesis say as a historical document? Not as a document that we're accepting as creed, but as a historical document, what does it say? It says, and as for Ishmael, meaning Ismail, Prophet Ismail, I have heard you. God is supposed to be speaking. I have heard you. Behold, I have blessed him and will make him fruitful, and I will make him a great nation. So there's something very early recorded about Prophet Ibrahim and about one of his sons, his eldest son, his first son, Prophet Ishmael, or Ismail, who we claim to be a prophet. And then another verse says, and God was with the lad, and he grew, and he dwelt in the wilderness of Paran. Okay? Now, growing up in the wilderness of Paran, what is the area of Paran? If you look at, for example, an encyclopedia on the Bible, if you look at the Catholic Encyclopedia or something like that, they will give you several different theories about what Paran is supposed to be. There's like at least 5 or 6 different theories. And if you actually look at, you know, without going into too much detail, if you look at the research, there's very good research to indicate that Paran is the area of Western Arabia. The area known as the Hijaz, where Mecca, Medina, Jeddah, Taif, all of these cities are located. And if you want more details, you can see the book that I referenced in the text by Allama Shibli Nu'mani. It's called Siratul Nabi. It's a 5-volume book. And he goes into a lot of details about why this is a good theory. And in fact, if you ask most people, they will give you different theories. No one has a straightforward theory about where the Paran is, because it's a wilderness, it's an area, it's a desolate area. And this was where the historical document or the Bible is saying that actually Ishmael grew up, where he went to. Now, what do the Muslims say? Muslims say that Prophet Ismail, he actually went to this area. This Paran area is where Mecca is, where Hijaz is, this entire area. So he actually traveled over there, and he went to a place known as Bakka, the Valley of Bakka. And Bakka became renamed later to Mecca. So Bakka and Mecca are the same thing. Okay, and this is also mentioned in the Quran even. So Prophet Ibrahim took his son, and this is a story that most people know, but it's a long story, we're not going to get into the details. But Prophet Ibrahim was a prophet, and he was commanded by Allah to take his wife and to take his son and to leave them in this desolate area. And there was a specific purpose, and we're going to find out what the purpose was. One of the purposes was to test them, to see whether his dedication to his family takes precedence or not. And another reason was because something was specific to happen in this area. And Allah had planned that he had a plan for this area and he had a plan for these people. So this was a test, as well as there was a further plan involved in leaving them there. So what happened? First of all, this area is surrounded by hills. Okay, so this is a valley. Bakka was a valley uninhabited. There's nobody there. It's surrounded by hills, so it's a valley, and it's very hot, it's very difficult to live. So what ended up happening, they ran out of food, they were running out of water, and Allah came and He sent an angel and He caused a well to spring up. And that well was known as the well of Zamzam. All right, so most people are familiar with that, the well is still there, it's still flowing till today. But the point is that because of the well and because of the source of water that was there, people began to inhabit this area afterwards. So this area was uninhabited before, and the tribe of Jurhum, one of the tribes, came, and there's a long story about what happened, but basically they asked for permission and they decided that they're going to start living in this area. And that's the origin of the city of Bakka, aka Mecca. So that's how this city actually came about, and it's important to understand that when the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, when he comes into the city of Mecca and what he's doing in the city of Mecca, it's important to know the origins. It's important to know what Arabia and what Mecca was like before he was actually born and before he actually started his message and his mission. So Prophet Ismail, right, Ishmael, also later known as Prophet Ismail in Arabic, he learned the Arabic language. He married within the tribe. He remained there with his mother, and you know, later on his father came to visit, but basically Ismail became an Arab. Okay, he became Arabized. He adopted the culture, he adopted the language, and he remained there and he lived there. Okay, now when Prophet Ibrahim had left him there, he came back. He did not just abandon him. He was coming back and he was visiting his son. He was visiting his wife. He was in constant contact with them. So it's not like this narrative that some people present that he just threw them away and then they were forgotten. They were not forgotten. It was a temporary period where they were being tested for one in particular thing, where the well came. And then the city is being established. So when he came back to visit his son, they both were commanded by Allah to build a structure, to build a building which is dedicated to the worship of Allah. Because there were several buildings throughout the world at that time that were dedicated to idols. There were several buildings at that time where fire worship was taking place. And in fire worship, for example, there's a fire and you keep the fire alive in the temple. There's someone who's dedicated to the temple, they have to just keep putting fuel on the fire, and the fire just keeps on burning, they're not allowed to let the fire go out. There are other temples that have, you know, different rituals and different practices and all of that, but there was no temple, there was no place, there was no space that was dedicated primarily to the worship of one God, of Allah. There was nothing at that time. That's why technically this is the first house that was built for the worship of Allah, whereas there were so many other places where other people were being worshipped. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala revealed to Prophet Ibrahim and to his son that I want you to build this building in this specific area, and it's going to be a place where Allah is going to be worshipped. Okay? So this is the Kaaba. And we're going to talk a little bit more about it. So are there any questions on this slide so far? Quite a few. Okay, keep in mind the question should be a question, and the question should be limited to 20 seconds, please. So please just follow those rules. Don't get intimidated, but please limit to those rules, yes. What were they before they took on the Arabic culture? They were living in a region of Iraq, like Mesopotamia and all of that. So they had traveled a lot. Ibrahim traveled a lot, but they were kind of in that area. Yes, so there's a discussion in Islamic books that Adam had actually built the first Kaaba or something like that. There's a lot of different opinions that scholars hold. One of the good balanced opinion is by Ibn Kathir is that Prophet Adam was he was in Mecca and he had the foundations of the building, but the building was not established. Just the area and the spot was holy, but the actual building was not there. Okay? Yes. So the question is, what did Prophet Ibrahim leave his pregnant wife and then did she give birth over there in Mecca? No. Actually, the child was already born and he left both of them over there because the child was already crying. So she did not actually give birth over there. The child was already born. Genesis is a book, is the first book in the Old Testament. And what the Jews accept to be the Torah is the first five books of the Old Testament are known as the Torah. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Five books. Five books makes the Torah, yes. According to the Jews and according to the Christians. We believe that the Torah was the original revelation that was given to Prophet Musa, Prophet Moses, but that's not been authentically preserved. That Prophet Ibrahim spoke Hebrew. It's not a very strong theory. If he did, he probably knew it as a side language, but that's not the area in which he, because Hebrew became more common later on. And the thing is, the Jews make a claim going back, but Hebrew was not known to be a traditional language in Babylonia or in the area of Iraq at that time. So they can make a claim, but I don't think the evidence for that is very strong. If it was, I would like to see it. Okay, so how old was Ismail? It's unknown. He was a young kid. He was a child. He was probably crying, or a young kid perhaps. It's unknown. How did Prophet Ibrahim travel? Did he travel slowly or did he travel fast? Or was he aided by a miracle or something? It's also unknown. Okay, so what do other faiths believe about Prophet Ismail? Okay, so there's a large number of Jews and many of the Christians have accepted the idea that Prophet Ismail, because he was supposedly the son of a slave, right, which is not proven, by the way, in Islam, that his wife Hajar was a slave girl. There's some reports in the Bible and some reports in Jewish tradition, but it's not 100% proven in any hadith or anything like that, that she was a slave. There are some people, Muslim scholars, who argue that she was a very honorable woman. But for them anyways, they say because she was the son of she was the child of a slave and the child of a second wife, he was an illegitimate child. And because he's an illegitimate child, he has no honor, no bearing whatsoever. So how do they explain, this verse? It's difficult for them to explain this verse, first of all. But the way they explain it, they say, he was going to be made a great nation, meaning like just a lot of people. He's just going to have a lot of kids. So there's another verse in the Torah or in the Old Testament which talks about him being upset and having anger like a donkey and certain really bad things, So there's some really bad stuff that's also mentioned in there. So how do you reconcile that God blessed him and God is going to make him a great nation and yet there's like some verse about him being a donkey or something? Like, how do you reconcile that? Well, I don't know how other people will reconcile it, but we believe that scribes and rabbis have added stuff to these texts. So therefore, that's probably one of the things that they added. Describing his anger or describing whatever it is. And these other things talking about. So there's a lot of slander against Prophet Ismail in the Bible as well. Even though there's these great verses, there's like some other things that are like kind of in there. And it's very difficult for people to reconcile. Okay. So let's move on. The house of Allah. So the Kaaba was the first structure that was dedicated to the worship of Allah, right? So that is something that's specifically mentioned in the Quran. So it's something that we need to pay attention to. It's something that we need to understand. There were so many other places. This is the origin. This is the first house. This is the first building where you're supposed to come and you're supposed to worship as a specific place. It didn't mean people didn't worship Allah, but it's the first structured place where people are supposed to go for this particular reason. And the building is actually very simple. The building is actually, if you look at the Kaaba, the original Kaaba, even today, it's simple. In that time, when Prophet Ibrahim was building it, it was even more simple. So it's built of stone, okay? It's built of small, like big stones, but still it's small building. It was rectangular in shape, okay? So today, if you look at the Kaaba, it's more cubic in shape. That was not the original structure. So it was actually rectangular in shape. And if you look at the Hatim, this area, the semicircular wall that goes around, those are the original boundaries of the original Kaaba. Okay, and we'll talk about what happened later on and all of that. But the original structure was a lot smaller than it is today as well. So it was like maybe a little bit higher than an average human being. It was not a very tall structure. And it also had no roof. So it was open from the top as well. A very simple, very basic structure. That was the Kaaba. And people would come. Prophet Ibrahim built this with his son. They would worship there. And they would, what did they do? They began to spread the idea and the belief among the Arabs in this entire area that you should only worship Allah and that you should not accept any other idols and you should not, you know, bow down to any other deities and you should get rid of all of these superstitions. All of these things came because they were being revealed to Prophet Ibrahim and later on to his son because they were both prophets. So they spread this message. So Arabia, this is not just building a building and them sitting there by themselves worshiping. Right? This is not Prophet Ibrahim sending his son and sending his wife over there and say, okay, now this revelation comes and you build a building and then this building just kind of stays there, nothing really happens. And then all of a sudden, thousands of years later, the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ comes and he starts, you know, making this call to Islam. That's not the way it was. Every Prophet's job was to spread the message. And Prophet Ibrahim and Prophet Ismail, once they built the Kaaba, they were spreading the message around, not just in the city of Mecca, which was a small city still at that time. They were spreading the message around through all the areas. And one of the ways in which they did it, this belief began to spread. But how did it begin to spread? Prophet Ibrahim was commanded by Allah to call the other people for pilgrimage. To call the other people in the entire area that you should come here, at least on a regular basis or yearly basis or whatever it was, that you should come to this place and you should be worshiping here. So we're not talking about some random haphazard belief. We're talking about an entire movement. We're talking about an entire system they're setting up that everyone should be coming. Everyone who's a true believer in Allah, who started worshiping Allah and removed the idols, they should be coming to this center. So Mecca became a center of monotheism. Monotheism meaning the belief in one God. The belief that you only worship God. Right? So they started becoming a center for monotheism or tawheed, what's known as tawheed in Arabic. So people were coming and people were flocking and they were coming to this place and they were worshiping and they were thriving. This is a success story that all of this was taking place. Now what happens? Okay, this becomes a house of Allah. So people start worshiping there and the call is to some extent, to whatever extent, we don't know, to some extent it's very successful. So people are coming there and they're worshiping Allah. How are they worshiping Allah? They would be bowing. So when you bow down, that's a form of worship. They did not have the exact same form of prayer that we have today, but they had something similar. So bowing is one of the very important parts of prayer. They were bowing. Prostration is one of the very important parts of prayer. They were prostrating. And another way in which they were worshiping was by walking around the house. Now some people probably never gave any thought, why would you walk around something? Right? What is the point of that? Sometimes people even walk around the Kaaba and they never think about what they're doing. So what does it actually mean for you to walk around something? It means that you make that actual thing the center of your thoughts, the center of your attention, the center of your life. Because when you're going around it, right, you're making it the middle of your path. Imagine this is your path of life. You're putting it in the center. And this is something that's common. Why does this work this way? It works this way because, you see, prostration, for example, has a universal acceptance. For the most part, there will be some exceptions, but for the most part, prostration in almost every society is seen as something where you're becoming subservient to the thing in front of you. Not behind you, not to the side of you, but you're putting to the thing that's in front of you. This is a fairly universal. Okay, if somebody, you know, contradicts it or something and says, I don't believe that, that does not, exceptions don't make the rule. So the rule is prostration means this. Bowing has a similar meaning as well. In a kingly court and things like that, people bow out of respect. Even in martial arts, for example, people bow. It's a sign of respect. It's almost in all cultures, it's a sign of respect. The same thing, this going around in circles, is something which is actually universal. If you study other religions, tribal religions or other major religions, you will find that many of them have something where they go around a certain area. And this applies in many places. So what Allah has done is Allah has commanded certain forms of worship which are already built into the universal custom of all human beings, or most human beings for that matter. So that it's understood why we're doing this. The reason why sometimes we may not understand that is because our perception as living in the 21st century is that all the religions, we're kind of taught that everything is backwards, everything's been messed up for all these centuries, we're the new modern enlightened human beings, and these are all messed up people in the past, so we don't try to look at the deeper things in which they're doing. Yes, we don't accept idolatry. Yes, we don't accept fire worship. We don't accept, you know, whatever dancing around the fire and, you know, whatever chants or things that are going on. But to not understand why they're doing what they're doing, to not understand even what their emotions actually mean, that's quite superficial, or that's quite excessively arrogant. So what we need to do is we need to understand that, and that's something that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala instituted, that why we go around because it's a form of worship. It's a form of worship that's been acknowledged in custom, and it's a form of worship that still exists in many places today. That's what they used to do. So they were walking around the Kaaba, and that used to become a very common form of worship. And that's the same thing, the way that we worship Allah at the Kaaba today. Prophet Ibrahim, he made a prayer. All of this is in the Quran. A lot of this is in the Quran, by the way. So all the verses are footnoted in your text. So Prophet Ibrahim made a prayer. And among the prayers that he made, he said, "O Allah, make this land safe and protect my family from idolatry." Among the prayers, he made many other prayers. Among the prayers he made, he said, "Make this land safe." Which land? This area of Mecca, this area, this region where Mecca is, where the worship of only Allah has already began to become fruitful. It's already started and it's moving. So make this land safe. Right? Make it a safe area. It's not going to be taken over. It's not going to be colonized. It's not going to be destroyed or something like that. And number two, and protect my family, meaning my family and all the people around me, protect them from idolatry. Now, why would Prophet Ibrahim make these two du'as? Right? Number one, these two supplications. Number one, make the land safe because he wants this, what he set up, he wants it to remain. He wants it to last long. And he knows that one of the ways in which believers, true believers in Allah, have been destroyed in the past was by somebody coming and taking them over and just wiping them out completely. So he's aware, because he's a prophet, he's aware of this history. He understands that this is one of the ways that can destroy the entire message of Islam in this area. And the second way that Islam can be destroyed in this area, Islam meaning worship of Allah, the second way it can be destroyed is idolatry. Now why would he say protect my family from idolatry when he's already teaching them? He's a prophet, his son is a prophet, and they're teaching them directly, this is, you know, you only worship Allah, you only do these things. Because, you want to answer it? Yes. Right. As a prophet, yes. So as a prophet, he knows the reasoning behind it, that's one. There's another reason. Yes, sister. So like Prophet Nuh's son, he thinks maybe, you know, the message will not carry on. Perhaps that's another reason. Okay. People may start getting into other things and giving value to other things and all of that. The people who read the text, there's actually another answer in there. If you read it carefully, it's there. Yes, exactly. He experienced it. He saw his own father making idols, idol worship. He saw his own people. He saw the king arguing with him. Those who know this are familiar with the story. If you don't know the story, it's fine. But basically, he had dealt with it in the past. His entire life, before he moved to Mecca, before he moved to Arabia, he was debating with his people. He was trying to convince them and trying to show them through proof, look, why would you worship these stars and moons and all of these things? Why do you worship this king? Worship Allah. And he couldn't convince most of his people. That's why he left that area. So he has 100% experience with it. And that's something which you understand gives you, it gives you like a sense of zeal. You know, if you've dealt with it, if you've seen your own parents go down a path that have been wrong, you're very careful. If you've seen, for example, your own kids going off and doing something really bad, it's affected you directly. That's what you find today, is you find people coming and say, you know what, you know, we need to focus on the youth. We need to focus on the youth, right? The people who are very adamant and saying we need to focus on the youth, oftentimes, either them, their own family, or someone very close to them, they've saw that their children have gotten messed up. And now they have a sense. Whereas other people who haven't had that yet, they're like, yeah, it's nice, you know, we should focus on that too. But they're not going to have the same type of thing that the people who went through that experience. The people who came from idolatry into Islam, they have that sense of, we're not going back to that. The people who came from worshiping Jesus and they came into Islam, they're going to look at that and say, whoa, whoa, whoa. Before you tell me to go and, you know, kiss this sheikh's feet or something like that, this is reminding me of this. And I came far away from this. I'm not going back near this. Do you understand? So experience gives you a very positive, optimism, positive sense of life. And that's one of the reasons why Allah tests us and He tests the prophets so much. Because it gives them an experience which actually continues to motivate them. Prophets are the people who are tested the most. So it gives them that power, it gives them that zeal. So Prophet Ibrahim, he made these two prayers. And then Prophet Ismail, after Prophet Ibrahim passed away, and probably his mother passed away as well, at whatever point in time, Prophet Ismail also became a prophet. So how do you become a prophet? Allah decides, He chooses you, and he receives revelation, so he's also a prophet. And what does he do? He stays in this area and he continues to teach people about all of the things, about the pilgrimage, about worshiping Allah, about how you should worship, about all the good qualities and all the, you know, bad things to stay away from. So the message continues in this area and the Kaaba becomes the spiritual capital of Arabia over a period of time. Whether or not it was in the lifetime of Prophet Ismail or it came a little bit later, the message continued, we don't know. But the point is that at this point in time, at this point in history, Mecca and some of the surrounding areas or some of the surrounding tribes had Islam. And Islam was established over there. Okay, Islam was established over there. So that's very important to understand. Any questions on this slide? Yes, yes, absolutely. So how do you answer someone who says that the Kaaba is like an idol and therefore you're worshipping it? Usually this question comes from Christian missionaries. And it's ironic that it's coming from, I just want to add this little point, it's ironic that it's coming from people who actually have a giant statue of Jesus inside their church, right? But nonetheless, it's something that should be answered, right? So the thing is, first thing you ask them is say, I usually when I give a presentation, I tell people when I'm telling them what the Kaaba is, and I say, you know, and people pray in this direction and they're praying at this building and everything. Guess what's inside this building that makes it so special that people are praying in this direction? And everyone starts guessing all of these different things and everything. You say nothing. It's absolutely empty. There's nothing inside of it, right? And that's the whole point. The point, the one, the fact that it's empty. The two, that it's the fact that it's unembellished almost. Three, that there's absolutely nothing in there. And if you look at it this way, if you look at all the people who've worshipped things throughout history, right? They've always been something of something important significance. Some idol, some shape, some tree, something that's considered to be special. And that's probably one of the reasons why the Kaaba is kept so simple. No one has an admiration for the building because of the building. Right? If it wasn't connected to Allah and that Prophet Ibrahim built it, there's nothing absolutely intrinsically special about it, and there's nothing inside of it as well. Right, so that's one of the simplest ways. And the other thing is, it says, look, if you look at it in isolation, and you say, well, I'm going to look at people who are worshipping over there, and I'm going to look at them in isolation and not understand what they're believing. No, what does the Quran say about idol worship? What does the Quran say about oneness of Allah? What does the Quran say about that? And if you go to anyone who's in front of the Kaaba, like if you go to like some people who are worshipping in a mosque which has a grave or something like that, some people will get it wrong. If you go to anyone at any point in history, throughout the history of the world, you know, but from the time of Islam, the Prophet ﷺ, if you were to ask them, what are you doing over here? Are you worshipping the building? Everyone would say, absolutely not. Right? So that's probably one of the clearest ways. There's so many ways to keep on going with that. But hopefully does that suffice? Yes. Okay, so the position of the Kaaba is directly in the sky above. It's actually above what's called Baytul Ma'mur, which is another area which is the throne of Allah, where the angels are actually going around and they're worshipping up there as well. So yes, from that perspective, right? Even though it's transcendent, but yes, from that perspective. Yeah, I think one of the most powerful things is to explain that there's nothing inside the Kaaba, right? Literally, there's nothing inside, right? So if someone were to say that, no, you're worshipping it for sure, are we worshipping the bricks or the stones? And if we're worshipping the bricks and the stones, we're going to actually find out the Kaaba had been rebuilt. So most of the stones that are there are not the original stones either. So if you're worshipping the original stone, people stop worshipping those stones. Why don't we take one of those stones out and start worshipping that stone because it's the original one that Prophet Ibrahim built? There's another answer. So usually people don't argue when you explain it to them. To be honest, from my experience, I've encountered this question several times, and when I explained it to them, most people were fine. Only people who would continue to argue are those who, you know, nothing is gonna, you know, nothing will appease them. You know, right? So yeah, that's a good argument as well. So if the Kaaba was destroyed for some reason, we would still pray in the same direction. So it's not the building. It's definitely not the building. Okay. So by the 7th century, what happened around this? Okay, what is the 7th century? Yes, so from the year 600 to 699 is the 7th century. Right? I'm mentioning this because some people actually think that 7th century means like 750 or 740. So you take the number and you go down a little bit back. So 600 to 699 is the 7th century. 700 to 799 is the 8th century. So that's important. It's very, very important for you to know. As a person studying history. So this was, by this time, by the 7th century, okay, around the year 600 somewhere, the Arabs had forgotten the teachings of Prophet Ibrahim and Prophet Ismail. They'd forgotten the teachings. The teachings are gone, the monotheism, all of that started going down, down, down. How did this happen? Right, how did this take place? Well, here's a number of things how it took place. Number one, what you actually see is that pilgrimage, right, coming to Mecca, worshipping Allah over there, going around the Kaaba, bowing, prostrating, all of these things, became a ritual. It's one step in the process. It became a ritual. So what does that mean when you have a ritual? Meaning you don't understand why you're doing. You don't understand what you're doing, you don't understand why you're doing it. So their parents, maybe they didn't teach them, and their grandparents didn't teach their parents, and they kept on doing the motion, but they didn't understand what they were doing, and they didn't understand why they were doing it. This is one step in how they forgot the true teachings of the prophets. Then, in the 4th century, right? We're looking at the 7th century now, how things had already become messed up. This is one thing. So in the 7th century, people are still performing the pilgrimage, what's known as the Hajj. They're still performing the pilgrimage. It's there. But it's just a ritual. They don't really know what they're doing, or they've changed the meaning. So people think, I think the Hajj means this. No, someone else says, no, I think the pilgrimage means this. And they're just go ahead and doing it anyways. In the 4th century, another thing happened. The 4th century is 300 to 399, right? So in the 4th century, the descendants of Ismail, up until this time, the descendants and family of Ismail, or the lineage of Ismail, continued to control Mecca up until this time. In the 4th century, the descendants of Ismail were kicked out of the city by one of the tribes known as Khuza'a, another Arab tribe, right? Because Prophet Ibrahim mixed with Jurhum, Ismail mixed with Jurhum, and they continued to control that area. Afterwards, around the 4th century, they were kicked out by another tribe. Which means that, you know, the spiritual, you know, lineage going back kind of was being shaken. Now, whether or not they were messed up already, Allah knows best. But it's something that's a significant event that took place in Mecca. Okay? And then around this time, with the tribe of Khuza'a, idolatry was introduced into Mecca. Now, how did idolatry get introduced into Mecca? Well, there was a man, it's reported that there was a man by the name of Amr ibn Luhay. And he went and he was in charge of the city, or he was one of the influential people in the city, and he began to bring idols into the city. Whether he brought it from Syria or whether he brought it from another region, it's not important. He probably found an idol somewhere, he was messed up in his own thoughts. So he brought an idol into the city. And people began to start worshipping idols from this time. This is how idolatry began to be, how it started. Because if understand this very important point. If the first generation after Prophet Ismail, who had learned directly from him, who were strong in their faith, if a man like this had come and brought an idol into the city, what do you think would happen? You think people would start worshipping it? No, because their faith is strong. They understand the message on all of these things. But here, with the passage of time, you kind of forget, what are you praying in the first place? What are you doing at the Kaaba in the first place? You can modify it, mess it up, whatever it is. Once you lose the substance of what you're doing, number one. Number two, your figures who are considered to be the head, they're kicked out. Right? The people who you hold in authority, your spiritual lineage, meaning the people who you respect, your history is destroyed. Your history that you held in such awe has been thrown out and dismissed completely, right? Like today, we live in a place where our history is being dismissed. Most Muslims don't know their own history. You throw that out, and now it's very easy to replace it with different beliefs. So first, you lost the meaning behind what you're doing, and number two, you've lost your historical connection to what you actually held to be dear. And now, idolatry can be introduced. Now you put an idol in there and you tell people that, you know what, this idol is something great. If you worship it and you just pay it a little bit of respect, it'll intercede with you on behalf of Allah, and you could get all this stuff done, and you don't really need to do much work, and everything's just going to be perfectly fine. This is how it happens. It's important to not think that all of a sudden, from day one, you know, everyone's worshiping Allah, and then all of a sudden, you know, oh, they just decided to start worshiping idols because they looked at it and the idol was so pretty they just couldn't resist. That's not the way idol worship starts. It's a gradual process, and it has to do with either ignorance, has to do with ignorance of your culture, your history, all of these things. So it's important to analyze and to understand how this actually takes place. So they had a few lifeless rituals. They had a few, you know, things that they were doing, and this is from the time of Prophet Ismail. It's not that they changed the form, right? They didn't change the form necessarily. They changed the substance. They changed the meaning behind the things. Some of the things they kept directly from the time of Prophet Ismail. That's why you're going to find that when the Prophet, peace be upon him, when he comes on the scene, some things he keeps intact, some things he abrogates completely. Because he knows what was a remnant from the time of Prophet Ismail, because he's the Prophet. So just keep that in the back of your mind. And then, during the 7th century, there were about 300 idols inside and around the Kaaba, in this area, that were being worshipped. That's how prevalent it became. Idol worship became very, very common. People used to go and, you know, they had big idols, they had small idols, they had portable idols, they used to walk around with them, they used to take them on their journeys, they used to do all of these things. So, idols became very, very commonplace. Some of the ways in which it began to spread even more and develop into different things is some stones, people used to take some of the stones, not from the Kaaba, but from Mecca. They used to take a stone from Mecca and they used to take it back with them. And they used to, you know, think that, oh, this is going to help me because Mecca is a sacred place. And now that since Mecca is a sacred place, we take a little stone, it reminds us of Mecca. And then after a little while, gradually, people start putting this stone in a special, you know, jar and on display. And then after a while, people go, oh, wow. People start worshipping it, and then it turns into an idol. So all of these idols started becoming like little portable idols, and people started carrying them. And it started with a good intention. That's the important thing to understand. Is that most of idol worship coming from the Prophet began with a good intention and it changed around. It became modified, it turned its way around. So that became problematic. Now, idol worship became an addiction. Okay? It became so extreme and so severe that people couldn't pray anymore without idols. Even though they had a concept of God, a concept of Allah, they couldn't pray without idols anymore. You just have to have an idol for whatever, for the sake of concentration or the sake of blessing or whatever it may be. So there was one Arab man, and this is a pretty authentic report, that this man, he couldn't find a rock. So he wanted something to worship and he couldn't find a rock. So he's looking around, he's traveling and he's looking, he can't find anything. So what does he do? He says, you know what? He has a sheep or a goat or something like that. And he takes a pile of dirt and he piles it together. And he milks the animal on top of it. So there's some milk, kind of solidifies and everything. And now he's got an idol and he starts worshipping that thing. Right? Somebody, he just milked an animal on top of a pile of dirt and he started worshipping over there. That's how addictive it actually became. So it's something that you have to understand. This became something that they couldn't do without. They just feel that you cannot go directly to Allah anymore. You have to go through this idol, and probably many people started worshipping the idol itself. Okay? There's another person at this time, it's reported, that he made an idol out of dates. He made an idol out of dates while he was traveling because he didn't have anything else, and then he was worshipping it. And then afterwards, he got really hungry, and he said, you know, I'm hungry, I need to eat something, so he started eating the dates. Right now, you'd think that, wow, back in the days this was something weird. This happened very recently. This is not something like, oh wow, 7th century or something. This happens today. In fact, this was, I heard it on the news, about 4 or 5 years ago. In India, they decided to make an idol out of chocolate. Now seriously, they made a giant chocolate idol. Okay, and everyone was worshipping the idol. Everyone was worshipping the idol. And it just happened like around that time, maybe a month or two or something like that, that there was a major massive heat wave in India, right? Bad timing, really, really bad timing. So what happens? The idol started melting. Because you can, it's very hard to keep that thing, you know, intact. You have the refrigerator units or whatever they use to keep it intact. So the idol started melting. So they called all the people from the village and the areas and everything, and they just, they ate it. And that's it. They ate it. That's so the thing is, the point is that this is not something that is non-existent anymore. We kind of look at the story and we think this, you know, I was way back in the days, right? People have changed or something like that. No, the characters have changed, right? The characters have changed, but the attitudes and the behaviors are consistent. Maybe not in every society, but there's a common precedence that goes across. Now, the thing to remember is that there's a footnote in your book. There's a footnote in your book which says that this was Umar ibn al-Khattab. Right? And when I wrote that at that time, that's the report that had reached me. But after investigating it in more detail, that report that it's him is actually fabricated. So you could just strike that from your notes. It was not actually him. Okay? Or it wouldn't reduce his status. But some people had took an issue with that. And that's actually true. It's not an authentic report. That's authentically attributed to him. Okay? Any questions? No, very good question. I'm not going off the Hijri calendar. So when I say 7th century, I'm talking about the Christian calendar, Common Era, CE. No, I went backward. I'm saying this is Arabia in the 7th century, right? And then I'm saying, how did this happen? How did all this idolatry come about? Well, there were some steps. And one of the important steps to get here was in the 4th century, this happened. Does that make sense? Because we're going up, right? We're going 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th century, right? Ismail was way thousands of years back. He's before year zero. So he's BCE. He's BCE. He's thousands of years BCE. Okay? So remember, there's calendars. So I'm glad you actually asked this. So remember, there's two calendars, right, that were utilized generally in studying Islam. One is the Hijri calendar, the calendar according to migration. And the other one is the Christian calendar, what we call CE, Common Era. BCE means before Common Era. This used to be called, probably when you were in high school or something, used to be called AD and BC, right? So BC used to mean like, I forgot what it means. Probably some people say before Christ, could have been before Christ. AD does not mean after death, by the way, okay? A lot of people thought it means after death. No, it doesn't mean after death. Anno? Domini, you're right, exactly. It means the year of our Lord. That's what it means. So Christian calendar, that's politically incorrect because no one besides the Christians except that it's the year of the Lord, because they believe that Jesus is the Lord and Jesus was born at that time. So that's not in use anymore generally. So try not to use AD and use CE instead. So we're going to use CE, stands for Common Era. Okay. I think there's a footnote probably in the book regarding this, I think, yeah. The one about Umar being the one who ate the dates that he was worshipping. Yeah, the thing is the report itself, if you look at the chain is so weak that it falls in the realm fabricated. That's the reason why it's considered to be fabricated, right? So, yeah, I know. Unfortunately, you hear it a lot from a lot of people. But see, the thing is this. The reason is because some people think that attributing this story to Umar degrades his status. But to be honest, from my perspective, it actually upgrades his status even more. Where he came from is amazing. How he changed now. But some people take very high offense to it and say, no, you're degrading Umar and he couldn't have been like that and no one could, you know, be like that or whatever. No, that's, I don't see it, but I'm just telling you for the sake of, you know, academic purposes, authentically, it's not that authentic. The story is most probably true. But the fact that it's Umar, the fact that it's identified as being Umar, that's the part. You can't trace it directly back to him. Probably someone was doing it, but we don't know if it was Umar or not. So it's a good point you're making. So people go crazy about the Kaaba cloth nowadays, right? Now the thing is, it depends on how they are, right? It's something that's dangerous, you know, in the sense that when you look at idolatry and how it started and all of that, but you have to kind of look at what threat or what potential reaction do people really have in the Kaaba cloth. Some people will say that, you know, it's just an honor. We really enjoy having the, you know, the cloth and all of that. It depends on how people you see them reacting to it. If they're really going crazy and they're really like, you know, treating it like something way, way up there or something like that, then they should be cautious about it. They should be very cautious about it. Okay? It's about their reaction more, because generally Islam closed a lot of the doors by putting more strict regulations for this ummah, for this community. So most of those hard and fast rules have been there, but you need to be careful about some things based upon people's behavior. So idolatry, how did it start up? All right, so let's look at what were the Arab beliefs at that time. Arabs believed in Allah as a creator, and this is mentioned clearly in the Quran. If you ask them who created the heavens and the earth, they're going to say Allah. The majority of Arabs actually believed in Allah. It's not that they didn't believe in Allah, they did. And they believed in him as the creator, right? So the idols were what? They were like the mediators. They were like the messengers that can, you know, like the get out of jail free cards, who like kind of, you know, the buddy who's going to go and talk to the president or the king on your behalf, and he's going to hook you up, right? The idols are basically your hookup person, right? They're going to take care of you. So that's why idol worship became so prevalent. So you can go and you can go through them, and people thought you can't go directly to Allah anymore. You have to go through the idol. So what would they do? They would bow down to the idols. How would they worship the idols? They would bow down same way that you're supposed to worship Allah. They would bow down to the idols. They would ask the idols as well for wishes, like, you know, can you, you know, grant me like a nice new camel, or, you know, can you give me kind of like what we do today, right, with cars and stuff. So they would go to the idol and they would ask them, you know, grant me lots of children, and grant me a nice wife, or grant me a nice husband, or all of these things. They would seek protection from the idols. So they say if they're going into a war or something, they would talk to the idol and ask, you know, protect me from this enemy, or protect me from these things. So they would do all of these things. Then they used to have a culture where they would dedicate certain animals to slaughter for the idols. So basically there were certain type of animals. They say these kind of animals have to be sacrificed to the idols. Either you choose some every year or every season or whatever it is to get something done, or they had some strange customs, like if an animal gives birth to a certain type of animal, another type of animal, say, well, this is quite rare. So this animal is deemed sacred now. So sometimes, like, this animal needs to be slaughtered. Sometimes no one's allowed to touch this animal, you can't kill it. So they would do all sorts of other things. They would slaughter, animals to the idols. They would give the idols gifts. They would maybe offer food in front of the idol or something like that. So give gold or whatever it is. And this kind of practice still takes place around the world in many places. And that's when it became an organized religion. I use the word organized religion because it became something that was systematic, and it became something that people were like a kind of like a little hierarchy or a clergy kind of started to develop, a very primitive form of like a clergy. So there were certain crops and certain animals that had to be dedicated to the idols. So certain crops that came out, so you have to give this portion, has to go directly to the idol. And like I said, the animal, if it gives birth certain number of ways, or if there's a certain type of animal that's born with like some deformity or some kind of different feature, say this animal has to go to the idol, and it became like a formula. It became like a, you know, like a religious rite, standardized law, that this is the way idol worship takes place in Mecca and the surrounding regions. So any sheep or camel giving birth to 10 children, for example, became deemed sacred. This is not being sacrificed to the idol. This means that if any animal gave birth to 10 children, it's sacred, you can't slaughter it. You can't get rid of it. So it just walks around, no one can mess with it, no one can touch it or anything like that. So they developed other superstitions that started coming out. Other Arabs existed at that time, they were materialists. Okay, materialists in the traditional, classical sense of materialism, where they only believe that, they believe in time. Like the Quran says, they believe that time kills everything. So they believe in cause and effect, they don't believe in afterlife, they don't believe maybe some superstition, some spirituality, but they say, you know, we live and we die and that's life. Don't worry about anything else. That's all we need to focus on. So materialists existed at that time as well, what you call atheists or something like that, materialists. There were people who worshiped the sun, there were people who worshiped the moon, there were people who worshiped different planets, there were people who worshiped different stars. And certain tribes, there were a few tribes who they would worship different stars. So this tribe worshiped this group of stars or this constellation, this other group would worship another star or something like that. So they had their own, they had their own like claim to idol worship. Okay? And most of the Arabs, even the ones who believed in Allah, they had very little or no concept of an afterlife. Why? Because if you're praying to the idols, if your main prayer becomes to the idols and you're bowing to the idols, what are you doing? You're asking the idol for wishes, stuff you want, and you're asking the idol for protection and all of that stuff. You're not asking the idol for success, you know, in the next life. You're not asking the idol for, you know, I want you to, you know, guide me along the path, you know, all of these things. Right? So it's important. Right? It's important. So it's important to understand. Can someone in the back just tap the brother? You awake? Okay, good. He's like dozing off, inshallah. So I just want to make sure. I'm checking that you're awake for your own good. So they had mostly no concept of afterlife, okay? So any questions on this before we take a break? When they started instituting, saying that certain animals are sacred and crops are sacred, that became an organized religion. Why? Because how could the idol communicate to someone else that this crop or this animal was sacred and had to be sacrificed? If you left it open and said anyone can bring whatever they want to the idol, then it's a free-for-all, right? You can bring whatever you want. When you have some people going and telling everyone else, you know, if this animal gives birth to 10 animals, right, then it's sacred. Or you have to give this kind of animal and this much crop to the idol. Who came up with that in the first place? That's how it became organized religion. Yeah. You're saying the prayer of Prophet Ibrahim. Yeah, so it's changed. But the thing is, first of all, it lasted for a very long time. It went away for a period, and now it's about to come back. And until now, to today, it's lasted again. So keeping it safe and keeping protected and keeping the family away, technically, the family had been kicked out, so actually the prayer was okay, because the ones who introduced idol worship were not even from the family, originally. Right? So the family was affected later on afterwards, but they recovered. They recovered. So this temporary slip, keeping the family safe and having the dua accepted, the supplication accepted, doesn't mean that every single person in your family. It means generally. If you look at it on a wide enough zoomed out scale, the dua actually was accepted. It was accepted. Okay. So we'll take a 10-minute break and resume at 9:04, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum.